Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Ricky Ducournay. She has been my guest before, and now her new novel, this has been a wait. I think it's her first in 5 years, and it's called what I'm going to say as Netsuke. It's a Japanese word. How do the Japanese say it, Ricky?
Netsuke.
And what is it?
So it's a small wood or ivory or jade carving that's used on a cord around the waist. Men used to wear it around their kimono to hold down the tobacco pouch, the tobacco and whatever materials they needed to smoke. And it's often erotic. It's often very, very beautifully made and strange. Many of the figures are complex and somehow uncanny. One of my favorites is called the Wasp Carver, and I mention it in the book. And the Wasp Carver is a wasp that's been eating away at the fruit of a plum or a peach or something and kind of boring its way into the flesh of the fruit. And it's disquieting and also somehow very sensuous.
The disquietingly sensuous is the subject frequently of the work of my guest, Ricky Ducournay, and Netsuke, is no exception. These figures, though, seem to be the product of art and extraordinary compression, which is natural, it seems, in this book, because this book is the narration, by and large, of a psychoanalyst who is like a wasp who's been boring into the fruit of the most sensuous kind, boring beyond the proper bounds of human curiosity, of scientific helpfulness. He is a psychoanalyst who's begun to seduce his most disturbed patients.
That's right. I mean, and so that was why this became the central image for the book. Not that I had planned it that way, but it surged forth, and it seemed perfectly right. We enter into the book at the moment when he begins to really tumble into madness. It's a thing which he enters into with enormous imagination and passion and self-justification, but he is fascinated by the erotic possibilities of his patients, and as patients often do come into analysis because of their fear of erotic life or a kind of alienation from the sensible universe, he has many possibilities there before him, a real choice, in other words, of people upon whom he can prey. And so the book opens at the point where this is really becoming something of a habit that he cannot shake.
Let's begin by hearing his voice. This is a section of the novel. It's its first official chapter after a brief italicized prologue.
And this piece that I'll read opens the book with a certain quietude and does come after the voice, which is in something of a fever dream and something of a rage. A small private park that Akiko has transformed into a scene from the Tale of Genji extends beyond the house. It has a broad path that leads to the public trails, thickets, a wetland, a lake. I run from our house into the public land in the mornings, often alone, in the early light. I can run for over an hour without hearing the hum of city traffic. This early in the day, there is something more than royal about this domain. It is mythical. I run toward the past, not my own past, mind you, but a distant primal past, a past in which my own infancy or the current lousy state of affairs or even the great city beyond the bluff is unimaginable. Today, when I return to the house, I see the lights are on in Akiko's studio. This means I will find a thermos of fresh green tea waiting for me on the kitchen counter, a sweet gesture considering how evasive I am with her. Akiko has come to confuse my evasiveness with a retiring nature. In her words, I am the silent type. My silence conceals a wealth of worlds best left undisclosed. We have been together 10 years, long enough for my idiosyncrasies to have faded into invisibility. Akiko, too, has faded. She is the white noise I have come to depend upon and possibly cannot live without. Akiko is witchy, clairvoyant. Her astonishing dreams are astute, surgical. They keep me on my toes. This marriage of ours puts us both at risk. She is in danger because I lie incessantly, and the habit of these lies has blunted her gift and confused her. Love has caused her to distrust her own intuitions. Yet I am in danger also because I cannot help but offer her clues. It is inevitable that sooner or later I will falter, offer one clue too many, and in this way bring us both down. When I fall, she will fall with me. Perhaps this is a comfort of a kind.
Ricky Ducournay, reading from her novel, Netsuke. It's published by Coffee House Press. Now, what interests me is that in this kind of novel, one would expect there to be a character who would verbally accost this doctor. But instead, he's been surrounded precisely by people who can't accuse him and can't speak to him because they are themselves in a state of traumatic disorder. Or his wife has become so passive around him. She's part of his decor. And it's interesting that you've made a book in which this central and monstrous consciousness cannot be pierced by anything around him. Why?
I thought it would be interesting to examine the monstrous in this way. In fact, he has been so cruelly pierced at one time, and these are pain of his surfaces on occasion, but he's been very good at suppressing it. But he has been deeply pierced and deeply hurt. But I thought it would be very interesting to enter into the mind of someone who is at that point of real monstrosity and alienation. We know, alas, a lot about what it is to be a victim. And I feel it's maybe interesting and timely to begin to fearlessly investigate the mind of the madman, or the mind of the monster, and I suppose that's the same thing. I've always been, as you know better than anyone, very interested in dogmatic systems of all kinds. And dogmatic systems are always abusive systems, and they're always about abusive authority one way or another. So I've written about the Inquisition and the Holocaust and dysfunctional family and so many other things. And so this very much fits into that. So, yes, I mean, I'm interested in taking on dark stories. I'm interested in investigating dark knowledge. And I think it was inevitable that I would hit someone like this sooner or later. And it did happen. I've been interested in psychoanalysis for a long time. And the promise of it, which I think is immense, and also the risks in the hands of the wrong person. And it's well known that often brilliant people will enter into psychoanalysis trained to become analysts because they wish to understand their own dilemma. And the ones who are courageous, I think, do manage to break through so that they can help patients without needing the patients to somehow serve them. But the ones who do not have the courage or whatever it takes to really examine their own dark story are a real danger to their patients, and there are far too many of those. So the problem of sexual abuse is, in fact, a very common one. I wanted to handle that also in ways that in which it had not been handled, really within the fever dream of a deeply disturbed analyst.
He's another of your characters who is in a trance of eroticism and sensuality. And in many of these characters, they are going to have to wake up. And this one seems to be driving directly not toward Eros, but by the end of the novel, toward death, toward Thanatos.
That's right.
That this is a character who cannot wake up from the nightmare of his past.
He's death-driven. And that is why what he is doing is so deeply risky, because it really isn't about transformation at all. It's really about annihilation. He longs for annihilation. He's someone who clearly, if one picks up the few clues that he leaves, has been so undermined and betrayed in his childhood that he's always had the sense that he did not deserve to be alive, that he did not have permission to live well. And so annihilation is something that he's always searched for. And as his world begins to crumble around him, and this he's the one who is responsible for that. I mean, he keeps pushing for that. But as all the structures that he's created to enable him to survive within the world begin to crumble, then this rush towards death becomes more and more inevitable and driven.
I'm talking to Ricky Ducournay about her new novel, Netsuke, often said by Americans, Netsuke, in case that you want to find it on your computer and to order it. It's a fascinating book, and in particular fascinating because this man, this psychoanalyst, has been robbed of his language. So that as a child, he remembers being told that his mother and her friend are coming back after an afternoon, I suppose, of shopping, but they're coming back from the land of milk and honey. And this has biblical resonances, but also the resonances for any child of sweets and treats, that maybe it's a coffee shop or a candy emporium, an ice cream palace. And the mother laughs at him, frequently says, "Look at that stupid look on his face." And so he discovers that for him, there's not going to be a land of milk and honey anymore, that any honeyed phrase can quickly turn into a punishment. Tell us about the land of milk and honey for this boy.
Well, it's so interesting that you notice that. Nobody else has thus far talked to me about the land of milk and honey, but that's one of the major clues or betrayals within his childhood, and is the indication, too, that his mother adores humiliating him and tricking him. So the betrayal is clearly pretty profound. But indeed, they speak about this place, the land of milk and honey, which is no place for a little boy. It's just a woman's clothes store, and I guess they sell their perfume and things like that. But he does imagine something absolutely marvelous. And I think he realized, too, as he describes this poor little child that he was, he sees himself already as something of a fool, had such a longing for something perfectly delightful in his arid world that the deception is tremendous when he arrives and realizes, yeah, there's no place for him here whatsoever. So that becomes a major moment for him in his life, major moment of deception. But what you say about language is so interesting, too, because that is another issue here, the way language is distorted. And I think we are so often betrayed profoundly by the abuse of language. So for example, I mean, the prime example is the example within the family where love is in fact hate, and that creates a confusion that makes it difficult for a child to survive well in the world ever after.
Well, he speaks a very unusual language, and I think that in the case of this book, the reader has to investigate it carefully. I had to reread the book because he speaks to us so calmly, so directly, so out of a kind of anesthetized sensuality that half the time you don't quite hear what he's telling you.
Oh, that's interesting. It's interesting because, of course, part of, I think, the mystery of his speech is that on the one hand it's seemingly very hot because he's speaking with an unbridled vocabulary about sexual encounters. But indeed, on the other hand, perhaps he's able to speak so blatantly because in some way he is at such a distance from everything.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ricky Ducournay, one of my favorite guests. She's the author, most recently, of Netsuke. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ricky Ducournay about her new book, Netsuke. It's a psychosexual journey into the mind of a man who abuses his power. In this case, he's a psychoanalyst, and his power is over already very disturbed patients. We're talking about the language that he uses, because psychoanalysis is also an investigation of language and how language gives us access to myth. But sometimes language is a way of shutting the door. And toward the end of the novel, he meets a man, a cross-dresser, named David Swanscourt, a fascinating name, but his alter ego, the woman he appears to be, is named Jell-O. Tell me why. Tell me how you arrived at Jell-O.
Jell-O named herself. I mean, when she appeared, her name came to me right away, and I think it's because she comes in many colors and flavors. curious thing about novel writing is that, at least in my experience, so often a book begins because a character appears fully fleshed with a big voice needing a book, and then other characters appear as the book unfolds. And when David Swanscourt appeared, I found him really fascinating. He's very, very beautiful, and he's kind of like a wild thing, and he has a way of prowling around the room. He doesn't settle. He's in constant movement. I mean, he's clearly always on the run, and he's been deeply, deeply harmed. And so he's been harmed sexually. He's been raped. Jell-O has been raped. And so he comes into the room wanting to protect himself, but also wanting to protect Jell-O, his feminine side. And the first thing he says to the doctor is, can I trust you? Can we trust you? Will she be safe with you? That's when they begin the work, that's the big question. And instead what happens is the analyst is absolutely floored by Jell-O and perhaps falls in love for the first time. I mean, I think something, there is a kind of abduction that takes place, and on both sides, and he is deeply enchanted, maybe because David Swancourt is such a brilliantly transmutable person, and his feminine aspect is so transcendently feminine, so over the top feminine. He's so deeply female when he becomes Jello, but then there is this strange disconnect, and it's very exciting to the Doctor because of course Jello is also a man.
Once this book starts, it is a destruction machine. There's no one to put up a hand and say stop. No one within the book who can protect the victimized women and men. One of them is a cutter. One of them has multiple identities. Some of them are drifting at the edges of the Doctor's life. They literally bore him. He wishes they would discover something that would compel them. He wishes all of his patients would be compulsive in some way, so that there's no scheme of daily life, of ordinary life. So there's nothing to protect the poor reader from the dreamscape of this very dangerous book, where finally taboos are going to be violated, but not in the delicious way of something being crumbled and crushed and now we're free, but these taboos are going to turn on their violator.
Well, that's fascinating, and I suppose that it's true. So you're right, perhaps that is a kind of web of seduction, though I've never really thought of it that way, and it certainly hasn't been conscious. But I think perhaps that for me what happens is that I am myself so deeply seduced by language, and I do enter into something of a fever dream each time. And I find that whenever a book is finished, whether it's taken a month or 18 months or 4 years, that at the end I do feel that I'm surfacing from some other place where I've been visiting for a while or hovering for a while. And so maybe that does happen to my readers as well.
Well, I kept finding fingerprints of Ricky Ducournay in this book. The two K's in the wife's name, Akiko, the fact that Ricky Ducournay ends with the same syllable with which Natsuke begins. I kept finding the book to be a kind of mirror structure from which the author is trying to enter here and do something to this narrator to stop him or retaliate against him. And the author seems to be being held back. All there are fragments of her presence as evidence in the text. And I even thought that Jello, that name itself, has something of the double L is where the double K would be. And I did very deeply feel that the author has a withheld relation to this book.
My interest from the beginning was not to withhold anything so much as to displace the voice, because I wasn't interested in writing a memoir or writing a novel that was in any way close to my own voice. I wanted to do something that would be much more demanding, perhaps imaginatively, and demand a courage of another kind. But above all, that would satisfy my own curiosity. Nabokov says something wonderful about when one writes from one's memories, the memories are no longer one's own. They belong to the book. And Oni says that with a certain bitter wistfulness. but it is that is also true, that there is a wonderful transformation that takes place. So the book begins to belong, not only that it belongs to the world, it's no longer one's own object, but it somehow belongs to itself. It becomes its, I really think of it as a kind of animal. It becomes its own animal, and it wants to leave the house and live its own life, whatever that will be. It's always a bit of a risk and a mystery to put something into the world. So to be clear, it certainly is not, in quotes, my story, but it is something that I was close to at one time, and that also could not help but resonate with my own deep interest in harmful behavior for many reasons. And I think now, especially, I'm thinking so much about the connection as, and I think our first time we spoke together, I talked about Alice Miller so many years ago,
mm-hmm.
but the connection between, yes, abusive family life, dysfunctional family life, and the immense dysfunction that we are living now. And I'd like to give one example.
Yes, please.
Since I've moved to the Pacific Northwest and I live very close to the sea, I can see orcas swim by from my kitchen window. When an orca washes up dead on shore, the people who take care of the problem of the corpse are dressed in hazmat suits because the orca's body is so full of toxins. That is how sick the oceans are. And the whole planet, as I think all of us begin to recognize now, is in really deep trouble. And I can't help but feel that our harmed species is having great difficulty in perceiving its responsibilities. And we're also a delicate species, and we have trouble facing difficult truths. So I think if I hoped for anything with this book, it was that it would present in an engaging and honest way difficult truths.
I've been speaking with Ricky Ducournay, author most recently of Netsuke, published by Coffee House Press. Thank you, Ricky, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.